Hello, my name is Elliot Johnson, and I'm a college baseball coach, and I'm here to talk to you about practical practice with two coaches. And what we're about to say applies not only to college players, but to high school, and can apply to youth sports and to softball. So I hope that you'll benefit from the things that we're going to share today. And I want to talk first of all about to those of you who are communicating with young men. I think it's a real calling to have a chance to coach young men and to help them to grow as men. And one of the reasons for being in this profession of coaching is to help kids to mature and to grow in other ways than just the physical. Certainly, there are character issues that are more important than winning ball games, and I hope that all of us share that opinion. I might say in line with that talent does become an issue. It's a physical game, and the best physical players often succeed over those that don't have quite as much talent, but it's always a challenge as coaches to treat those kids that don't have as much talent as good as we treat those who are very skilled and talented athletes. But it is a physical game, and those outstanding players make us look like good coaches, and sometimes that isn't always the case, is it? It costs something to achieve, and that's one of the values that I'd like to promote and to be reminded of when we talk about coaching on a team. This isn't intramurals. I remember not playing very many intramurals throughout high school and college, but playing on a team sport that it costs me to go to practice. It costs in hours of sweat and learning and sacrifice as a team player, and I think that's one of the values that we share when we coach these team sports. The aspiration to win is assumed. There's nothing wrong with winning, and we shouldn't shy away from achievement. And I think that's one thing that needs to be said in our culture today, that sometimes kids hesitate to exert and to stand out. And I think it's good to have an aspiration to achieve and to succeed and to win, and yet to realize that winning at all costs is not what we're about either. That there are more important things than winning, and we've talked about the character issues a little bit. So if we can learn to win with humility and lose with honor, I think that's one of the values that is very important as we coach these sports. Let's talk about, as we think about working with an assistant coach, and many of us are at programs where we just have one assistant, and he becomes a very important person. And who we hire is going to have a lot to do with our enjoyment of coaching the sport and the success that we have. And so I want to think about some principles of hiring and what kind of people that we work with. Number one, an assistant coach must be a coach and not a player. And sometimes when you hire an assistant coach, we take a player who has played for us or one who has come from another program, and if their mentality is not a coach first and a former player second, then we sometimes have trouble. You don't want an assistant coach who is one of the guys, is one of the players, because you can't really be effective as a coach if you're still thinking like a player. And young guys who aspire to be head coaches someday, they soon learn that the mentality is different once they cross that line and come over to the coaching point of view. Secondly, an assistant coach must be a teacher and as well as a learner. We all can learn more. None of us knows everything that we need to know or could know about baseball. And so all of us are continually learning. I used to trick my kids who come to camp and clinics and ask them at the very beginning, how many of you know everything there is to know about baseball? And of course, right at the beginning, a lot of them would raise their hands, 7 and 8 year olds, and indicate they thought they knew everything that there was to know about the game. And then that led to the chance to say, wait a minute, none of us knows everything that there is to know about baseball. And we all need to keep learning. And yet, an assistant coach needs to be a teacher as well. He needs to have an interest in communicating the principles that you're trying to communicate in the sport. Third, an assistant coach needs to be assertive and not passive. And sometimes if you have a person who's not very assertive as an assistant coach, and he's a little passive, then you end up coaching him more than you do the players. And you need a person that's a real coach and not just, again, a passive person. An assertive coach is of great benefit because he frees the head coach to participate more in another area of responsibility on the field, and you do a much better job. And so if you have to coach every position, you won't do as good a job as a head coach as if you had an assertive assistant. Number four, an assistant coach should be a self-starter and not lazy. The more initiative that he'll take, the better your program. And of course, if you're a strong head coach, you don't need to be threatened by an assertive assistant. The best coaches aren't threatened by an assistant that takes initiative and is assertive. Number five, above all, is the idea of loyalty. An assistant coach must be loyal. You won't always agree on everything. None of us agree on everything. But you can disagree on some things and still present a united front to the players as long as there's loyalty. And there's a lot of fun to be had between head and assistant when you have a loyal assistant and you're on the same page. So never compromise that trait of loyalty. Sixth, an assistant coach should be sure of his role. You should write out exactly what you want the assistant coach to do and where you hold him responsible and accountable. And you should give him the authority to do those things. And he should have no question about his role. It's a good idea to prepare him to take over your job one day. And you never know what the future holds. You don't know what his plans are, but it's a good idea to let him know what your role is in writing and how you see that role so there's no misunderstanding and you have thorough communication. Number seven, an assistant coach should be trained. You should train him to take over a head job if that's his aspiration someday. Now, some people don't want to be head coaches someday. Some are content to be career assistants, and that's fine. But if he does, and you should find out what his aspirations are and help him to meet those aspirations and to achieve in his own life. And finally, number eight, your assistant coach should be fulfilled in his job. Use his strengths and he'll become much more fulfilled and he'll enjoy his job more. And the more he enjoys his job, the better job he'll do. And the more you'll enjoy your job and the better your team will do. So those are some thoughts about hiring if you have the power to hire your assistant and you should have a say in who helps you because it makes a big difference when you start to plan practice with one assistant coach. Well, let's talk about fall practice then the schedule that we might start with. And we're talking about a year-round program in a school where we have a fall program, where we have an off-season program during the winter months, probably indoors, and then we have a spring season. So we'll talk about the fall schedule first. First of all, when we start a pre-practice session, it's kind of informal. If my assistant coach is able to get to the field at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 2:30, and let's say that we have assigned him the responsibility of coaching the pitchers, which we have, then he can have pitchers throw their bullpens and be supervised before practice even starts. And I will not be out there because of roles in the office and administrative things, but he can certainly get practice started with his pitchers before the formal prep part starts and get a lot done and a lot of good individual coaching done there. Some days I might be out on the field and take an individual group of pitchers, infielders, or outfielders and do some things with them. And he might work with another group too early before practice. And that's a good time to really focus in on a small group. Then when practice starts, we'll start with a formalized list of drills, and we have suggested practice schedules that are available, but one of the drills that we really like is called machine bunts. And the machine bunt drill is where we take a pitching machine and we'll set it on the mound behind a screen and we'll put runners on first and third base and We have a batting cage, as you can see in the diagram, and the coach will stand on the side and he'll time the runners as they bunt the ball off the machine and then run to first base. And so each runner is working on bunting the ball, and we work a lot bunting the ball down the third base line, so we put a third baseman there, and we put a row of pitchers right there by the mound, and so we're working on the pitchers fielding the bunts, or the third baseman fielding the bunts and throwing to first base, and we're timing the runner as he has laid down a bunt and he's running through the bag. Now, we have runners on first and third as well. The runner on first is making sure the bunt gets down, and he's rounding the bag at second base, hitting the inside corner, working on a good turn, and heading towards third base. If you had extra coaches, which we don't, you could put a player in the third base coaches box if you wanted to, and he could signal the runner from first base whether to stop at second or continue on to third. Your runner on third base is going to work on a drill where he tags up. He's pretending that it's a fly ball to left field. It's really not in this drill, but he's pretending. The left fielder stands there with a ball, and when the ball is bunted, he throws himself a little pop-up, and he'll catch the ball, and when the ball hits his glove, the runner on third base can leave and head towards the plate. And so we have runners working on seeing the ball down from first, rounding it at second. We have a runner at third base working on not leaving too soon on a sacrifice fly to the outfield. We have a bunter runner running past first base and getting his time. He's working on getting there as quickly as he can. We have pitchers working on fielding. We have a lot of strikes because it's with a machine. Every pitch is pretty quick tempo. They're not arched and they're not just tossed. They're pretty much game speed. And the bunter is getting the ball down. And once in a while, we ask the third baseman or the pitcher who fields the bunt to make a bad throw. And that's what this line indicates that's dotted past first base. We want a bad throw. And why do we want that? We want that because we want the runner, as he passes first base, to glance to his right and check for a bad throw. He stays on the line unless he sees the ball going all the way to the dugout over there, and then he takes a quick left and heads to second. But if he never bothers to look, he might not get an extra base on a bad throw in a game. So we do that a lot. We get a lot of machine bunts early in practice, and I think that's a pretty effective drill. Then we have a little adaptation to that drill. We'll put runners on first and second instead of first and third, and we'll work on another phase of it where we ask the bunter to read the shortstop. Sometimes a team on defense will run a wheel play where the shortstop will run to third base, the second baseman will run to first base, the third baseman, first baseman charge, and the pitcher charges, and they are determined to not let the runner on second get to third. Well, we don't want to bunt into that, because the chances of success are not very good in bunting into a wheel play. So we will ask the bunter to read the shortstop. If they're going to run that play, the shortstop leaves early. And when this bunter sees that, he just brings the bat back and slashes the ball. And there's so many holes in the infield, his chances of a hit are very good. So we work on reading the defense when they might run a wheel play. So those are, we call machine bunts, because we use a pitching machine and we get a lot of repetitions with that drill. And we usually do it early in practice. There's a lot of running in it. There's focusing on the ball as it approaches the plate, making contact, and we're able to improve our bunting skill by that drill. Another drill that we like to do is called, in our defensive period, we have several other drills in defensive period, but I want to just talk about this one because we've just made this up about a year ago. It's called See and Out. And what we do here is we will have the assistant coach, one assistant coach here, and he'll hit a fungo to one of the outfielders. We have, as you see on the screen, line of runners there down the first base line. We have the whole defense in place. We'll have a runner on first base and a runner on second base with huge leads. And when we hit a ball to an outfielder here on this drill called See and Out, and by the way, the reason we call it this is because we want the outfielders to make sure they see an out at the plate before they throw it all the way to the plate on a single with a runner in scoring position at second base. So unless he sees an out in his mind that this is going to happen, he's got an out, we don't want to throw to the plate. We want to throw to second base and keep the batter runner on first base where we have him in position to turn a double play on the next hitter. So we call it seeing out. So if this, in this case drawn on the screen, the right fielder fields the ball, a hard hit single by the fungo guy, the runner on second is going to attempt to score, and the right fielder reads the distance that the runner has covered, what his odds are of getting an out. He also has a runner going from first to third. That's an option. So he's got a tough job, doesn't he, to read where people are and make a play. And then we've got the batter runner rounding first base and heading towards second. As you can see, the pitcher gets off the mound, and he is going to back up either home or third base, depending on where he reads the throw. The first baseman steps into cutoff position, and he's going to either cut the ball off if the catcher tells him to, if the throw has been to the plate and there's no play, he cuts it off and we go to second with it, or he's going to let it come through. And we do this drill with all the outfielders and quite a bit. I think the outfielders often get neglected in baseball and softball practice, and with this drill, they're getting a lot of repetitions of where to throw the ball, making a decision first, and then throwing the ball accurately and on a line, and trying to keep that batter runner on first base where we can keep him in double play position. So we call that drill see and out. Another thing you can do with this drill is you can have the first baseman hold the runner on and let the pitcher have an option of picking a runner off before the drill even starts. You could also let the catcher have an option of calling a pitch out and picking, so the runners are kept alert. Another thing that you could do is put a on-deck hitter down here opposite where the runner scores and works on telling him to slide or to stand up at home plate. And so there's a lot of different things involved in that drill, and many times we neglect to reinforce to the on-deck hitter that he needs to get there and signal the runner coming in to score whether he should slide or not. So we call that drill see and out. Then we go to team time with two coaches, and when we go to team time, here are a couple of other drills that we really like. The first one here, and these both go together, the first one here during team time is where we have three fungo hitters, and this is where we this is how we take mass fungos. I think it's always more useful to have a runner running to first base. It's more practical, it's more realistic if we have a runner, and we make plays and put a little pressure on the infielders. We want the drills to mimic game situation as much as possible. So one coach, the assistant coach usually, will go to center field, and he's going to hit fungos to the outfielders from center field. He's going to have a base out here. He's going to have two shaggers, maybe two bases, and he's going to have these guys throw to bases in the outfield while the other coach works with the infielders. And so he'll hit fly balls over their heads. He'll hit them ground balls. He'll hit them line drives to the outfield. I really like hitting fungos from short center field like that. It's more of the angle that they're going to catch balls at anyway in a game rather than hitting from the right field or the left field line. They're going to be coached to throw high to a relay man. You could put a relay person out here, play them deep, put a relay person in, and teach them that you always throw as an outfielder high to a relay man, and you throw low to a base. So when they throw to a base, we want to throw low, even on one hop. And they're being coached by the assistant out in the outfield. While that's going on, the other coach, the head coach, could be in the infield, and we have three fungos hit, one right after the other, and we just continually bombard the infielders with fungos, and the runners run everyone out. These are usually pitchers, and they get some running in this way, and they're going to run past first base and put pressure on those infielders. Here's an idea how you can work on different kinds of fungos, and these fungo hitters, 1, 2, and 3, are pitchers that have learned to hit fungos well, and we'll put a line of runners on third base for this drill. And these are pitchers also. And so the infielders are in their positions. Fungo hitter number one will hit a ground ball to third base. Now, we have three different kinds of ground balls that we want to field. The first ground ball to the third baseman, he's going to hit a ground ball to him, and we'll put him in what we call three depth, which is shallow. That is in. When we define depth, one depth would be deep at the back part of the infield dirt. Two depth would be medium depth, and three depth would be very shallow, even with the bag. And so fungo hitter number one is going to hit a ground ball to third baseman at three depth, and he is going to check the runner at third base and then make a decision what he's going to do with the ball. If the runner on third goes to home, he's going to throw to home, and we have an out. We don't slide. We don't want to get anybody hurt in practice. So he's going to throw to the plate, and we've got an out. If he doesn't go, he's going to throw to first base and get the out there. That's the three-depth drill. Immediately after that ground ball is hit, fungo hitter number two, who's over here on the left side of the plate, hits a ground ball to the shortstop. He'll hit a regular ground ball. The shortstop fields a regular ground ball, and he throws to out another runner that's running to first base. He's got pressure put on him by the runner, and he throws a guy out at first base. Immediately after that happens, the third fungo hitter, right here on the right side of the home plate, hits a slow roller to second base. The second baseman charges the slow roller, throws across his body to first base, out. So we have three different kinds of ground balls on this drill. A ground ball to a player playing at three depth, a regular ground ball, and then a slow roller. And all of them make the plays under pressure, and outs are recorded. And then we start right over again. The fungo hitter in the first base circle hits a ground ball to third base, three depth, does it again. Shortstop, same as he just did, second baseman, slow roller, and we just keep going. And it goes boom, 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 boom. And you'd be surprised how many ground balls you can get with three fungo hitters and just continually hitting those balls like that. Then after a few minutes of that, we'll change the type of ball we hit to each fielder so that the fielder at third base would field a slow roller. The fielder at shortstop would then field at three depth. He would come into the edge of the grass, and now he is reading the runner leading off third base. And if he's going to score, then the shortstop throws him out. And the fielder at second base fields a regular ground ball. And so we'll do that for several minutes. And then after that, then we'll switch roles again, and the third infielder will make the play that he hasn't made yet of one of those three types of ground balls. So it's a way to work on different kinds of ground balls, get a lot of repetitions in, only two coaches. The outfielders are being coached by the other coach, and we found it to be very effective. I think it's more effective than just having them standing back in their position and taking a ground ball and not throwing it and no pressure. And that's the way we take ground balls in the infield. Now, we haven't hit a ground ball to the first baseman, have we? So we have a way to do that, too. And after we get done with this drill, we'll put two first basemen in place, one playing, as you can see from this diagram, at one depth, another playing on the bag, holding a runner. And so what we'll do then is have two fungo hitters. The first fungo hitter will hit a ground ball to the first baseman playing at one depth or deep. He'll make a throw to the outside of second base to a shortstop covering the bag, and we'll record an out there, no runner on this drill. Immediately after that takes place, the second fungo hitter will hit a ground ball to the first baseman on the bag. He comes off the bag and makes a throw to the inside of the base to another shortstop that takes that throw. And so we can get a lot of ground balls to first baseman and appropriate throws with that drill. Then we'll have the first baseman change roles and take ground balls from the other position. And That's the way we get the first baseman their ground balls. We don't believe in having first basemen throw from one depth to third base. It doesn't happen in a game. You would put your first baseman in if you wanted him to throw to third. You would never have him throw from one depth deep in the infield all the way across the diamond to third base. And so we will throw a lot to second base, though, from there. So this gives them a lot of repetitions from that position. So during team time, those are a couple of drills that we really like. Another part of practice is batting practice. And here's a slide that shows the system that we like to use during batting practice. We will like to rotate players from one station to another as hitters in BP. We have a tunnel down the third base line, and they'll be on their own down there, working on hitting on simulated 0-2 or 2-0 counts, throwing to each other. We always want to work in the cage with a purpose. And we don't just go down there and swing the bat at balls. We want to simulate that it's 0-2 or 2-0 and change their approach accordingly. And after a group hits in the tunnel down the left field line, they'll come to the batting cage at home plate. And at home plate, then we will have, say, a group of three hitters, maybe four sometimes, but usually three. And they'll have three different at-bats, and they'll have 1 minute during which they hit. The first minute, they will hit to the backside, try to hit to the opposite field for 1 minute. Then their two other members of their group will do the same thing. And then for the second minute, they'll hit as if it was an 0-2 count. No balls, two strikes. They need to protect the plate and free them up a little bit to swing at pitches even an inch or two off the plate. And then the third minute that they have in batting practice, it would be a 2-0 count, and now they need to be selective and make sure the pitch is where they can drive the ball. And so they'd have 3 minutes. Now you can change the amount of minutes you give them depending on the number of hitters you have. You could also give them certain number of pitches if you wanted to, but I prefer to use a certain number of minutes. The head coach can stand at the cage and run the clock, or if you have a student manager, he could do that. The assistant coach that you're working with, the one assistant, can be at second base, and he can be rolling ground balls to the second baseman or the shortstop here, and they can be turning double plays and throwing to a first baseman set halfway between first and second behind a screen. That's the purpose for the screen. Or you might have a player do that, and you might have the assistant coach be the batting practice pitcher, depending on the abilities of the personnel that you have. The third rotation of the hitters is to go, after they hit in the cage, to go over to the side, and we'll have a chinning bar over there, and they'll do the maximum amount of chin-ups that they can do, and then they'll also do bicycle crunches. We believe in a lot of ab work, and bicycle crunches are one of the best exercises to develop strong abdominal muscles. So we have three places where hitters go, from the tunnel to the batting cage at home plate and then to a conditioning section. They also could take extra, if you wanted to, you could put a tee and a net at the third station and have them hit off a tee. The more swings they get, the better. Actually, the more quality swings they get, the better. And so that's the way we like to rotate in batting practice. Now, there's a couple other things that you might want to use in baseball or softball as you had practice here. We put the outfielders in their positions, and they're reading the ball off the bat. And they're always going to take each hit as if it's a live game situation. They're going to step up as the pitch is made to get their momentum on the balls of their feet, and then they're going to react to it. The extra pitchers, we don't just have standing in the outfield in a clump, but as you can see from the diagram, we put a pitcher on the left field line. If there's a ball hit over the fence, he quickly hops the side fence and goes around and gets it. We put a pitcher on the right field line, and he can chase foul balls that are out of the park from there. Then we have pitchers in the alleys, and so they will field balls that only the outfielders do not get, but otherwise this is practice for the outfielders. And so it's ideal if you don't have too many hitters to hit or too many fielders in the field, and you can do a much better job with a roster of 20 to 25 than you can with 45. And so I think in education we know that the teacher-student ratio is important, isn't it? We have the outfielders throw balls into a shagger behind the screen in short center field. So as you can see, we'll use a lot of screens. One, two, three, four, five screens to do all this work here in batting practice. And so these outfielders never throw it all the way into the mound. They throw it to this shagger behind second base. And the purpose for the other screens, we have a first baseman here behind a screen, and he's catching balls from a fungo hitter that's out here behind the second baseman. Now, he has to be pretty skilled to do that. And you don't want to get too many hitters on the field at the same time if they are not skilled with how to hit the ball. So you may or may not want to add this part of it. But if he is a skilled hitter, he can hit a line drive one hopper to a first baseman here, and he can work on picking the ball out of the dirt behind this screen while batting practice is going on. Now, the other two fungo hitters are going to be on each side of home plate, and after a pitch is made, they're going to hit a fungo to the first baseman or to the third baseman, and then after a while to the shortstop if the drill at second base is finished. And you can get a lot of work done in batting practice with that drill. In fact, you can incorporate so much activity in batting practice it dominates really most of your practice. And that's the way it should be, because baseball is a game of pitcher versus hitter, isn't it? And the more reps we get between pitching and hitting, the better. So that's how we'd take batting practice, and there are certainly variations of that if you wanted to use them to become more effective, but that's one way to do it. When we scrimmage, we have both coaches observing the scrimmage and instructing, and the mental part of the game during a scrimmage is extremely important. We don't want to stop a scrimmage to do a lot of talking about physical things. We'd rather work on physical things during drills. But we will emphasize the mental part of the game as both coaches observe and instruct, and maybe between innings as a team in an inter-squad scrimmage has come off the field, we'll say something to them. And we'd rather not talk a lot during the scrimmage because of that part. One thing we do like to do during scrimmage is that every hitter is charted on how he does against every pitcher on our team. So we'll just take a sheet of paper, and across the top of the page, we'll have a list of all the pitchers, and then on the side of the page, we'll have a list of all the hitters. And then we'll have lines and boxes, and we'll fill in what each hitter did against each pitcher, including how hard he hit the ball. So we have a pretty good book after fall practice of 7 weeks. We'll have a pretty good book on what each hitter does against each pitcher and how effective the pitchers are against certain hitters. Another thing that's helpful and really necessary when you have just two coaches is to divide responsibilities with players. So when practice is over, everybody has a job, and we have a sheet of paper that has all the jobs listed that might need to be done in preparing the field for the next day's practice. And each guy has his job. And we use this for games as well. And so we might have pitchers fixing the mound. We might have catchers fixing home plate. We'd have infielders brooming the edge of the grass and getting any dirt that's got into the grass out. And then we have our assistant coach drags the field. And to get the drag off, sometimes there's a lot of dirt there that accumulates under. One person's responsible to fix that. And then we might have a player or two players actually blowing out the trash from the dugout, picking it up, blowing it, or blowing out dirt with a blower. We'll have players responsible for putting the flag up for games and taking it down, turning the scoreboard on. All the jobs that are necessary to have the field ready for the next day, we do right after practice, and it really helps the two coaches a lot when it's all divided like that with players. And you can't do it yourself as a head coach, and two coaches can't even do it. So we need to share the responsibility and the authority to get it done. And we have, as we said, a tunnel, two tunnels outside the field down the left field line. The balls and tees and any bats down there need to be picked up and put away, and they likewise, before practice starts, someone needs to put out the screens, put out the balls into the tunnels. If there's a machine that we use, someone needs to get the machine set up. All that is done by players. And if we had five coaches and a full-time student manager that was hired and paid, then it'd be a different matter. But we have two coaches, and we have a whole team of players, and it's good for them to take responsibility. So that is another important part of coaching with two coaches. Well, when we go to the indoor phase of practice, we call it preseason because that's really what it is. And we're indoors. We'll still do early bullpens. We happen to have an indoor dirt mound, and I would recommend that. I don't think you can prepare a pitcher adequately on an artificial mound with tennis shoes, but I think that we needed this mound. It's an indoor dirt mound. We throw with cleats. We build up pitch counts before the first game. And the assistant coach will meet with the pitchers early, and they'll throw bullpens. If there's a special session of work that the head coach can participate in, he will take hitters or maybe infielders and sometimes catchers and work with them in a small group prior to practice. And then when regular practice starts, if it's, say, at 3:30 in the afternoon, we'll start with a lot of running drills. We like to do sprints and a lot of different types of drills to stretch and get loose. We do dynamic stretching over and under hurdles. We do a lot of core work with the body. We'll again do those bicycle crunches, and we'll do a lot of back exercises where we lie on the belly and do what we call Supermans, with raising hands and feet 6 inches off the ground, and then the right hand and the left foot, left hand and right foot, and do a lot of back exercises, believing that it's important to condition the muscles that are antagonistic to the abs. And so both coaches are involved in that. In fact, we even participate with them because as adults, we sit too much, don't we? And we don't get enough exercise. And whenever we can, when it doesn't detract from practice, we'll participate too. Now, I think as a coach, you have to know when it's detracting from your coaching to condition yourself. But if you can, I don't see anything wrong or negative about participating with them when it's possible. When we hit indoors, we'll hit off of tees, and we'll hit with soft toss a lot. We have two indoor cages, and everybody's facilities differ somewhat. In this case, with two indoor cages and a turfed area inside, we have a chance to field ground balls and to work on a lot of situations. But oftentimes, if we're hitting, I'll take the hitters, and the assistant coach will take the pitchers for pitcher's drill work. Not all of them throw bullpens every day, of course, and so they're on individualized programs. Some will run, and some run in different programs. Some will be running longer distance, some will be running sprints, some will be throwing medicine balls, some will be doing a lot of different conditioning that he is in charge of. Again, that's where it helps to have a coach who's an assistant who is both knowledgeable and takes initiative. So that's a real blessing. When we hit live in the cages, both coaches are involved. The pitching coach, the assistant coach, is helping the pitchers. Now we are hitting off of artificial mounds and tennis shoes, and we're throwing live. We don't usually throw more than four pitches. Each hitter hitting live in the cage only sees four pitches at a round, and then they change hitters. We try to make it as much like a game situation as possible. We also, with our second cage, have hitters hitting half cage, throwing to one another. So we're able to involve a lot of players there. And then another station outside the cage where we're throwing live, we have a first base set up with a first baseman holding a runner. And the runner is getting a jump on the pitcher's move to the plate. The pitcher's holding the runner. So even though we're indoors, it's wintertime, we're still working on it as much like game situation as possible. The runner's stealing second. We put a piece of cardboard down the turfed area, and he slides on that. The first baseman steps inside when the pitch is made, throws a ground ball to a shortstop. They turn a double play with a second baseman and throw it back. Sometimes we'll have him throw it in the dirt and make the first baseman dig it out for work there. So we're getting a lot of things done inside, and the head coach can be coaching the hitters and or the base runners, while the assistant coach is coaching the pitchers in a game situation. So the assistant coach would be working in this game situation indoors, on the pitcher, varying his times to the plate, once in a while stepping off to hold the runner close, and once in a while even throwing a pick over there. Now, you say, how does that happen? He's in a cage. That's right. He can't throw it and actually have anybody catch it. He just makes a move to first base and throws it into the side of the net, signaling the runner to get back. So the runner can't assume that he's always going to be running on each pitch. It's not perfect, but it's the best thing we can do being indoors. And so those are some ideas about how to run an indoor practice with just two coaches. That's not all there is to it, but there are some ideas. Your facilities will determine what you can do. But you may be able to do a little bit more than you think if you use your coaches wisely. We lift a lot of weights. We believe in weight training, but baseball-specific weight training. We aren't trying to lift weights to impress anybody at the beach. We do a lot of dumbbell work. We do a lot of work with bands. We do a lot of ab work, as said before. A lot of controlling our own body weight with chin-ups and push-ups and different stretching exercises in the weight room. And we just happen to have an assistant coach that's very knowledgeable and enthusiastic about weights. And that goes a long way. Your enthusiasm is the important thing, I think. And it's not always what weight exercise you do, but it's how intensely you stay with it. And it's how you keep boredom from creeping into lifting. So we believe in lifting. We believe in lifting baseball specifically, exercises that are specific to baseball. And we believe in enthusiasm in carrying it out. And the weight sessions last about 45 minutes. And we lift 4 days a week, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. And we try to have similar routines on Monday, Thursday, and similar routines on Tuesday and Friday. So the head coach doesn't even always have to be in there while weight training is going on. Can be, but may be able to get to the office and do some work during that 45-minute period. We also believe in swimming. And I think this is this needs to be, you need to think about, because we don't get enough arm activity in baseball today among kids. There's too much sitting, video games, and not enough activity with the arms. And swimming is a great exercise. And so we'll go to the pool two nights a week. In a college situation, I think that's reasonable. If you have a pool at your high school or in your junior high school, you may be able to use that. But at least twice a week during the preseason, and even during the season, I have found over many years, it really has kept injuries to a minimum. We cannot remember an arm injury to a shoulder or an elbow when we've swum. Now, 1 year we didn't swim. We had a damage to the pool area and didn't have a pool and couldn't swim. We had some arm injuries. And I may be overstating it, but I do think that swimming is a great exercise for injury prevention of elbows and shoulders. And I'd hate to coach pitchers, especially without swimming a couple of times a week during the off season. During the games, we divide duties, and the head coach, and it's how the head coach decides to divide duties is up to him, of course, but in our case, I like to coach third base, because I feel a little more in control. I feel a little like I can get signs in a little bit quicker to the base runners than I can from the dugout in relaying signs to the third base coach and then on to the hitter or the base runners. So I will coach from third base. The head coach is also responsible on defense to position infielders, and he changes pitchers, and he may even call pitches sometimes. Now, that depends on your idea of should you have the catcher call the pitches or not, and each coach has their own philosophy about that, but sometimes we may want the head coach to call pitches. The assistant coach, if he's the pitching coach, and in our case he is, we have him coach from first base for the most part. Now, at times he may go down to the bullpen when a reliever's warming up and supervise that bullpen. I think it's important to have a person supervising bullpens as much as you can. He may go to the dugout at times, and we don't have this problem right now, and I'm glad, but sometimes on some teams with both coaches on the field, and you only have two, remember, then there might be some criticism in the dugout that's detrimental to the team during the game. There might be some second guessing. Let's face it, all players, in fact, no player is always going to agree with the decisions a head coach makes. When we bunt, when we hit and run, whether we steal or not, no player is always going to agree. There's always going to be a disagreement at some point. You can, as a head coach, you can't worry about it, and you can't worry what they think. But at the same time, if there's a player or two in the dugout that wants to voice criticism, it's like a cancer, and it detracts from effort that guys put forth. It may be necessary at times for either the assistant, and usually the assistant, to be in the dugout just to stop anybody that might think about saying something verbally about why don't we do this or why don't we do that. We have done that before. And like we say, right now we don't have that problem, and I'm thankful. But you can use your assistant, and again, that's where loyalty comes in, isn't it? You cannot compromise on the loyalty requirement for an assistant coach. And so he's there, and he is just an extension of the head coach and the philosophy that you're using. The assistant coach, if he's the pitching coach, may call pitches at times also. And so that can also relieve the head coach of that responsibility. And if you have a knowledgeable pitching coach, maybe he's been a catcher, maybe he's been a pitcher, maybe neither. But he might have a good insight into how to set up hitters and how to call pitches. And so sometimes that may happen. And he can also position the outfielders. So we have differing responsibilities and roles with the head and the assistant coach. They're delineated, and we each know what each is doing and responsible for, and it works very smoothly. So we also need to involve players because, again, at a small university, we don't even have the support personnel that you might at a major university. Of course, a foul ball at a pro game or a major school is going to be a souvenir for fans, but that's not the case at a smaller school, and those balls have to come back. And so I got very tired of yelling at all the players in general, go get the foul ball. So what we've done the last several years is we have a shag boss. We have a pitcher of the day who is responsible for getting the foul balls. Now, that doesn't mean he chases any ball. He doesn't. He is the boss. He tells other pitchers which ball to go get, and they better listen and go get the foul ball. And if the foul ball isn't chased, guess who gets yelled at? It's the shag boss. So we try to teach a chain of command, lines of authority, on little things like foul balls, and it relieves the head coach of the burden of yelling at the team in general to go get the foul ball, and we don't have to yell at the pitchers in general. It's just one guy that's a pitcher not pitching that day who tells other pitchers, go get the ball. Now it's your turn. Now it's your turn. Now you go. And so he spaces it out, remembering that tomorrow when we play again, he's not going to be the shag boss. Another pitcher that he's just sent the day before to get foul balls is going to be. And so they have a tendency to distribute the job fairly when those conditions are like that. So we found that works and like that idea. And then, of course, we said earlier that players are responsible to maintain the field after the game, and they do their jobs after the game. We have pregame batting practice. They set up the cage and the screens. After batting practice, they take the screens down. At the end of the day, they get the field prepared. The assistant coach drags it, of course, but they do the other little things that need to be done to get the field ready for tomorrow's game. So those are things that help us to run a program with two coaches and we need to involve the players. In the office, as you know, as a head coach, there's a lot of jobs that have to be done from the administrative standpoint. And we see the head coach's job to schedule things like making travel plans. We take a spring trip to Florida for 2 weeks, and flights and motels and meals and all the travel plans. We divide the area. In this case, we're talking about a college. We divide the country into areas for recruiting purposes. We plan and promote camps and clinics. We do a lot of camps and clinics because we believe in helping kids. And that if you don't advertise and promote, you don't have anybody come. So that's important. We sometimes teach classes. Sometimes you might have to teach more classes or less, depending on the semester that it is. Ordering equipment, interviewing players. It's important to maintain contact with your players, and we spend time in the office talking, keeping lines of communication open, checking on eligibility, making sure each person is keeping up in classes and he's not going to have an eligibility question at the end of the semester. And by the way, I think it's only a wise investment to invest in players that are serious about their education. We don't want to worry at the end of each semester whether the person is going to be eligible or not. We want a person that's going to be serious about education and getting a degree, so we don't have to hold our breath after every semester to see are we going to have this player for the spring season. And it's just a poor investment of scholarship money to give to a person who doesn't care, and we have to be harassing to get him to go to class. So we just want players that are serious about their education. Then we also have a banquet every spring. We call it the First Pitch Banquet, and we've always invited a former major leaguer to come and speak and talk about his experiences in the big leagues and some character issues that we think are important along with that. And so selling tickets and getting the word out that this is going to happen and trying, it's a fundraiser, trying to get people to come and to make some funds to help fund our spring trip is a job of the head coach. And the assistant coach can help too, but we delineate his responsibilities a little differently. We say he has the job, in our case, of driving the bus and scheduling the bus. We have a team bus that's a nice-sized vehicle. It requires a CDL, and he drives the bus and makes sure that it's available for the days we need it. He recruits an area. He responds to walk-ons. He helps to direct camps and clinics also. He does private lessons. Our assistant coach isn't paid like a minor league manager might be, or like a coach maybe at a major university is paid. So he does a lot of private lessons and makes some income that way. He plans the pitcher's routine. He does a very good job at planning conditioning for the pitchers and their rotation schedule in training. He also interviews players and keeps contact with players and helps to publicize clinics as well. It's possible to have an outstanding small university program with just two coaches. It takes a little more time, maybe, although if you have three or four coaches, which is certainly a better situation, it takes time to plan and administer that program as well. But you can do it if you're in high school, if you're a youth sport coach with just two coaches, if you're a softball coach, the principles are all the same. And maybe some of these drills are helpful to you, and maybe some of these thoughts will help you in your coaching. Thank you for listening.